Again, I want to thank Aaron for being able to make it here from Washington after all the weather and for pinch hitting like this, and for being so willing to go a little bit longer in a little more detail on Reggie. Please forgive me, Reed, for trying to impersonate you. That's just not going to work out very well here. But I will try to do my best in covering at least the EU emissions trading scheme and what's going on. And if we think about the EU emissions trading scheme, it covers all 25 EU countries, but we can really think about these countries splitting them up into the original EU countries, the original 15 countries of Western Europe, and the new accession countries that have just come into the EU in the last 5 years or so. And all of these countries are going to be involved in the emissions trading scheme, although two of the most recent members of the EU, I believe Cyprus and Malta, don't have any Kyoto targets for greenhouse gas emissions reduction. So that could, even other small countries, there is the potential for leakage there. Over here, you can see where some of these countries are, located in terms of their greenhouse gas emissions, where they have to go given the targets, which are going to be at 8% below 1990 levels. Some countries have some room to actually grow. Other countries have room to or don't have any room to grow and must be pretty aggressive at reducing, with Germany and the UK having to make the largest reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Now, one of the things about, if we think about the EU versus the United States, North America in general, is that especially the EU 15, the original 15 countries within the European Union, if you notice since 1990 here, their greenhouse gas emissions haven't grown. If anything, they may look like they're actually declining ever so slightly over the last decade and a half. If we think about the demographics in these countries, they don't have huge population growth. They have very low fertility rates, and they're depending upon migration or immigration to keep their populations up. And their economies over this time period relative to North America have been not growing nearly as quickly, and hence economic activity not growing. There hasn't been this increasing demand for energy that we've seen here in North America. So it's a slightly different looking situation here. And so in order to get to that 8% below 1990 levels within the EU, it's not a real stretch when we think about it. It seems challenging in a North American context, certainly, if we think about the growth that we've seen in the last decade plus. In the EU, that may not be such a stretch to make that mark. And so that's one thing I think we need to keep in mind here if we're talking about 1990 levels. And people are saying, wow, the EU must be doing something really great, and they must be making these huge reductions, when in fact, they need not be making really large reductions. And so if we think about how they're going about climate change, really, there's more than just the emissions trading system. That's just one part of it. There's also a suite of programs that look very similar to programs that we may have here in the United States. One of the things that they want to try to do in the EU is to promote renewable energy, especially wind farms. These proposals for wind farms in the North Sea off the UK, Norway, and the Netherlands. There's, a huge solar PV rollout that's going on in Germany with some very generous subsidies and incentives. But they're really looking at a renewable portfolio standard type program in the EU, not too dissimilar to what's being discussed in Congress with the idea of a national renewable portfolio standard. They're also trying to use energy efficiency and demand side management measures to get at some of this. Again, not exposing this to the trading system, but just saying we're going to invest money in these programs. Transportation, improving transportation efficiency, similar to our CAFE standards here, and then, of course, the emissions trading scheme in this particular case. So their greenhouse gas strategy is more than just emissions trading. Now, in terms of the scheme, this may be shocking to many people, but the emissions trading scheme doesn't even cover half of the greenhouse gas emissions that are coming from the EU currently. It's only about 45% of those emissions. And so, you're not targeting anything, and there is a potential for leakage into other sectors if you don't meet these other command and control type targets, whether it's the renewable portfolio targets, whether it's the energy efficiency targets. If those don't come up as planned, they'll have a hard time meeting those 1990 targets. The emissions trading scheme covers, of course, the electric utility industry. It also covers heavy industries such as steel, on aluminum smelting. It covers paper mills. It covers all heavy industrial processes, cement kilns, of which North Florida seems to be full of these days, for those of us here in Alachua County and the general area. All of these sources will be covered under the trading system. Now, unlike the RGGI scheme, there is a mandate within the EU that in the first phase, or I'm using the EPA phraseology, in the first time period until 2008 here, 95% of the allowances must be allocated free of charge. Individual member states can't decide on their own, much like they can here in the United States, to auction them off 100% in the RGGI region. They have to be given away for free, and of course that comes down a little bit. This is not actually terribly dissimilar if one looks very closely at the Bush administration's Clear Skies proposal. If you look at the Clear Skies proposal and you look over time on the amount of allowances that will be allocated for the criteria pollutants, of course, Clear Skies doesn't include carbon, but if you look at the allocation, in the initial years, the allocations, there will be large allocations given away for free, and then over time, up to 2050, increasing amounts of those allocations will be auctioned off. This is similar in vein. We see a similar proposal here in the EU emissions trading scheme. Now, the other thing that's interesting here, and this goes to the offset issue that Karen was talking about, is something called the Clean Development Mechanism. Under the Kyoto Protocols, that with the concern that there are non-signatory countries or developing countries that will be experiencing large economic growth, will also be experiencing growth in their carbon emissions. And the concern is that we want to make sure that if we're controlling emissions, we want to at least provide an incentive for these countries to develop cleanly. Without getting into any of the social justice issues that some people may bring up here, the idea is that a company within the EU, let's say E.ON in Germany, can go to a developing country in Africa and install solar PV systems, as they've done in places like Namibia or Uganda, or install biomass generating systems, as has been proposed in other parts of Africa, with the idea that they will now be generating these carbon credits that can be transferred back to the EU. It's similar to the offset idea that Karen was talking about with RGGI. One of the things that's interesting about this clean development mechanism, however, though, is this idea of additionality. Are these carbon offsets really additional to what business as usual is? And it's dubious in many developing countries as to whether that's true, especially when you consider that the rates of electrification in many of these countries are on the 5 to 10% level of the total population. They'll take any electricity any way they can get it at this point. There are also situations in more developed countries in Latin America where you have pulp and paper mills, two that are being proposed in Uruguay currently, one by a Finnish firm and the other by a Spanish firm. And as part of those pulp and paper mill production processes, they're going to have a lot of waste wood that they had planned on burning for their own production use to create steam and then generate electricity to resell back to the state-owned utility in Uruguay. And they were going to submit these for CDM credits back in the EU. But the question again becomes, if they were going to use this wood waste anyway, they were going to generate electricity and steam anyway, are these really additional? And so these are the kind of issues that are going to come up in, as we think about carbon policy here in the United States. This is a very controversial provision or way to offset your carbon emissions in the EU. And if you talk to people who actually drafted this, some of this language from the United States during the Clinton administration, they're almost regretting that they did this because they view it almost as a big loophole that one could drive a truck through. To get credit for carbon offsets without really doing much in terms of offsetting total carbon emissions. If we think about the EU's size, the EU emissions trading scheme, in terms of carbon, let's contrast this to what we know very well, which is the sulfur dioxide trading scheme. Just the sheer value, and same is true in work that Karen has done also with some of her colleagues at RFF. The thing that I want to point to here is this estimated value of the allowance allocation. The sulfur dioxide program, anywhere from $3 to $5 billion per year. It's an order of magnitude higher for carbon in the EU, and would be even higher yet in a North American context, depending on what the cap looks like and what the allowance prices might be. And so we're talking about the point that Karen was trying to make about the different allocation schemes. We're really talking about allocating a big pot of money somewhere because you've got this asset called an allowance, a carbon allowance, that could be used to generate electricity, could be used for economic activity, or could be sold in the open market. It'll be reflected in prices that consumers pay. And so there's going to be large political fights over this. And much like here in the United States with the sulfur dioxide program, the reason the EU has decided to allocate for free the vast majority of their allowances is to get political buy-off from industry. And it's no secret here in the Title IV program that in order to get industry to sign off on the program, those allowances had to be allocated for free because they were worried about being unduly affected. In a market environment, as we're seeing from some of the work at RFF and what we've seen in the EU, that may not be the case. Price volatility, though, is something that's very interesting in the EU. At the very beginning of the program, we saw prices go up from a low of about €7.50 at the very beginning of the program to a high of almost €30, which would be, given the exchange rate these days, about $42 US per ton. And then we saw prices stabilize a little bit and then come back down again. And what happened, we saw these prices come back down, and people were kind of wondering why, until they looked very closely at the allowance allocation. It turned out that the targets that were set for these heavy industries, including the utility industry, were not very stringent. In many cases, in many countries, the caps were not binding, which drove the allowance prices down close to zero. We've seen allowance prices, going back down here again into the 5 to 10 euro range. More recently, they have gone back up again. They're now in the 20-euro range, looking at the latest market data. But the whole point here is that we have this volatility, in part because of the way allowances were allocated. But there's also something else going on in the EU, and that is they don't have banking in their emissions trading scheme. Unlike here, where if you don't use an allowance, you can spread out your compliance over a long time period. Many companies have done this in the sulfur dioxide program. Many companies anticipate doing this in the Care NOx program, where they'll over-comply in early years and then use those excess allowances to make up the difference in later years. Southern Company, it's been part of their strategy over time, and it's been very successful for them in terms of smoothing out their cost of compliance over time over the whole system. That doesn't exist in the EU emissions trading scheme, which is going to make this kind of volatility occur more often, and it's going to make it harder to plan given the price of these allowances, this instability. But there's also one other thing that's going on here with the increase and the decrease in prices. This initial increase in prices, in large part, also was driven by the idea that European emitters in the EU were being told that they wouldn't be able to buy credits from Russia. Russia, let us not forget, in 1990 was going through a tumultuous time, shall we say. Their economy has contracted significantly. Their energy usage has contracted significantly. They have many credits to sell, and many members of the EU thought they could buy credits from Russia, hence the low initial starting price. But again, the change in rules on the fly made people panic. Oh, we're not going to have these cheap credits, and then prices went up. And so getting the rules right, getting those rules set up in place is a really difficult deal, has been a difficult deal in the EU. And just simple things that I've mentioned, we've seen this different price volatility. So what's been going on with the emissions trading scheme? What are the lessons that we can draw from this? Well, one is actually setting a scheme where the caps probably ought to bind, for starters, because the caps really aren't binding at this point. Probably introducing banking would be a good idea to help eliminate some of the price volatility that we've seen within the EU emissions trading scheme. Administratively, it's actually very similar, I would say, in terms of getting the CARE NOx program and the Clean Air Mercury Rule implemented here in the United States. If you think of the EU, think of the EU government as being the federal government and all the member states as being states like our own. And getting each member state doing its own thing, just like each state here in the U.S. is doing its own thing on CARE and CAMR. It might be easier to have just one federal piece of legislation here in the U.S. The EU doesn't have that luxury in this particular case. I'm not going to get into some of this. I've already mentioned some of the issues with the allocation and the clean development mechanism, the credits. Monitoring is hugely important. And in fact, with the cap and trade program, one of the proposals that we've seen here from industry in the United States is that to have an economy-wide cap and trade program versus having a cap and trade program only in large industry here and then having other sectors such as the transportation sector, which in California, in their proposal, the transportation sector is the single largest sector source of carbon emissions. And so getting them involved in cap and trade may be good, and it's a matter of having technology catch up with the policy at that point. How do you monitor all those mobile sources? And with that, I've run out of time completely. But thank you for your attention and for your forbearance with Reed being unable to make it and allowing Karen and I to walk through some of this stuff. I've run a little bit over time, but we're willing to entertain a few more questions from the audience here before the break. If there are any other questions, yeah, Bob. Well, the EU actually looked at the U.S. experience in cap and trade programs, and so for that. Well, part of it is that Europeans believe more in climate change politically and socially than what we do here in North America, I think would be safe to say, politically. But I also think that if you look at reducing to 1990 levels as they have under Kyoto, their targets aren't as challenging. And in conversations Karen and I have had, not only is it not challenging because they haven't grown, but they've also got a lot of efficiency gains that can be made very easily in their industrial processes and so forth. So it's a little bit easier for them to get to than maybe it is for us. That may be why they're signing on to that. But I can't get into the heads of the policymakers in Brussels beyond that. Actually, that's not entirely true. They're still paying over cost and what they could do to build it themselves. Well, give us a second.